Hello, and welcome to the Bookshelf Conversation, the podcast segment of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with authors, artists, musicians, filmmakers, anyone who has anything to do with baseball and pop culture, because that's our slogan. If it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. Two of my favorite pastimes are baseball and the movies, so when a book comes along about a baseball movie, you know I'm all over it. It was therefore with great joy when I learned a while back that Richard Sandomir, the former sports media columnist for the New York Times, was working on the backstory of The Pride of the Yankees, one of the most beloved baseball flicks of all time. Pride of the Yankees has been the subject of many rumors over the years, especially over how the film was shot. Some have mentioned that because Cooper was a right-hander and couldn't convincingly portray the baseball skills of the left-handed hitting Lou Gehrig, they had the actor running the bases counterclockwise in a uniform with the team's name printed in reverse, and other wild theories. No spoiler alerts here, but just a couple of items that really stuck out for me from Sandomir's work. The role Eleanor Gehrig played in influencing what was eventually brought to the big screen, for example, and the almost anti-baseball philosophy held by the film's producer. And finally, that Cooper's luckiest man speech from the film has become the de facto version since there was no recording or transcript made from the actual comments made by the real Gehrig. And with that, I give you the Bookshelf Conversation with Richard Sandomir. Richard Sandomir, welcome to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Thank you, Ron. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Well, baseball and movies are probably my two favorite topics in the world, so this becomes like a Venn diagram with the Pride of the Yankees right in the center. And this is a fascinating book for those who love baseball, for those who love the movies, for those who know and appreciate the tragic story of Lou Gehrig. How did you come to write this book?
Well, I've been fascinated for quite a while with Gehrig's luckiest man speech, and that just blossomed into being fascinated by how Gary Cooper translated that into his version of the speech in Pride of the Yankees. And then the more I got interested in that, the more I got interested in the entire movie and how it probably more than any sports movie ever has perpetuated the life of the subject beyond which Lou Gehrig might not have had the afterlife these last 76 years since he died.
Now you mentioned Gary Cooper's version. I find it fascinating that nowhere does there exist a full representation, a full account, either on film or recording or transcript of the actual speech.
Yeah, it is interesting that I think part of the reason for that is that no one was prepared for a speech. If the planning for Lou Gehrig Appreciation Day on July 4th, 1939 had said, you know, Mayor LaGuardia is going to speak and Jim Farley, the Postmaster General, is going to speak, and at the end Lou Gehrig is going to speak, there was no such planning like that. So if somebody was going to transcribe it or if radio was going to record it, that was out the window. There was no advance knowledge of that. The newsreel companies were there, but in the end, what's left of the newsreel is some of the celebratory aspects of the marching band and some of the early speeches, and only just a few pieces of Gehrig's speech. And where the rest of it is, we don't know. It could have just been thrown out. It could have just disintegrated over time and not preserved well. But what I found fascinating, even more than that, is that it's possible there was never an actual written version of the speech. Because remember, what we've seen of the speech and what we've seen described of the speech is that he went up there with nothing in hand. So, and then when Eleanor Gehrig was communicating with Sam Goldwyn, the producer of the Yankees, she said, I want Gary Cooper to give the speech the way my husband gave it, and here is the speech from memory. So what she had from memory has become the official version. She gave it to Goldwyn. She put it in her book 30 years later. But there's no certainty that is the actual version. It's close. I think it is, because you look at all the newspaper accounts of the speech, and you see these lines here and there. But If there was a speech, why did someone like Eric, who had never given speeches before, was a shy guy, why would he go there without any notes? That he did it without any speech or notes is pretty astonishing. But, you know, the stuff that I found just indicates that, you know, there may never have been an actual written speech, unlike, you know, Lincoln writing Gettysburg Address on an envelope.
How much of a hand did Eleanor Roosevelt have in this movie? Roosevelt.
I thought you'd catch that.
Any role at all in this movie?
She might have seen it, though. Eleanor was as involved as she could possibly be. She was from the beginning. One of the things she did was help Paul Gallico, the first writer of the screenplay and a very extensive outline. They sat for a couple of weeks in adjoining offices in San Francisco, and she just poured out her life to Gallico. And there's 38 pages of notes from that. From those conversations that I found in the Goldwyn archives. And she would later, as the filming was going on, she would send letters to Goldwyn or to Goldwyn through her agent, Christy Walsh, and she'd have like 10 or 12 things that she didn't like about the script that she felt needed correction. So she'd say, well, it's all well and good that you have loose parents there at our wedding, but they weren't there. And you can't have Miller Huggins sign my husband while wearing a suit and sitting in the Yankee offices. That's just not the way things were done. Huggins was in a baseball uniform. It would have been Ed Barrow signing him. She didn't win all her arguments. One that she sort of won was she saw in an early version of the script that that Gehrig was supposedly hit 4 home runs in a World Series game, and she said, "No, you can't do that." But I say she sort of won because there is the famous sequence in the film where Gehrig promises 2 home runs to little Billy, who is the kid with polio in the St. Louis hospital, and he promises 2 home runs, and he delivers, and that becomes probably the biggest hunk of baseball action in the entire movie. He didn't promise 2 home runs to any little boy, but, you know, better than 4.
So I'm trying to get the combination here. Was she ultimately all right, because he was portrayed in such a heroic light, was she all right with the final product?
Oh, she loved it. She loved it. She came out of, well, you understood how attached she was to the movie, because one of the last things they did was shoot Cooper's delivery of the speech on the soundstage. Although it looks like they did it at Wrigley Field in Los Angeles, the actual speech of him speaking in front of microphones was done in a soundstage, and Eleanor slipped into the onto the stage, and because she was weeping while they shot it the first and second time, she discreetly left, and then she was given her own screening, and she voiced how much she loved it. Now, she said she also told Teresa Wright how much she loved her portrayal of Teresa's portrayal of her. But of course, years later, when Blythe Danner played her in the NBC movie about Eleanor and Lou, she told Blythe that don't play me like a sweet thing, a young sweet thing, the way Teresa played me. I'm a tough cookie, so play me that way. And Blythe said that she was kind of scary in how vociferous she was, but she sort of split the difference because, you know, look, Eleanor, if she could have been a flapper, she would have been. But she had a great time during the Roaring Twenties. She roared a lot. She drank. She played cards. She played the horses. She was a working woman at a certain point. And Eleanor liked the fact that Blythe was shown drinking and playing cards, which are two things that Teresa didn't. In the end, Eleanor got it both ways. I think she probably liked Blythe's portrayal better, but she knows that Cooper did a great job portraying her husband, and she wanted him to play the part. Goldwyn went through the charade of this crazy, you know, search for the actor to play Lou Gehrig, but it was always going to be Cooper unless Cooper broke both legs and they had to go with somebody else. But I think she had every reason to enjoy the movie, and you know, anything negative about Lou that was in early scripts was taken out.
Now, let's talk about Cooper for a minute. You mentioned several parts of the book how he was not an athlete.
Mm-hmm.
He grew up a cowboy almost and then didn't really involve himself in sports. Yet he also had a role as a baseball player in another movie, also with Walter Brennan. Was that Meet John Doe? I forget.
That was Meet John Doe. And, okay. And you could tell in the very little that they showed of him throwing a ball that he had a problem with his shoulder. He had injured it as a stuntman, riding horses. And but it ultimately, how he played baseball and the fact that he had to be taught to play baseball for 6 weeks by Lefty Abdul didn't matter. Goldwyn didn't want a baseball movie. There's only 10 to 12 minutes of baseball action in there.
Which I found, you know, having gone back and looked at it a couple times since reading your book and picking up on some of the items you mentioned, I found that, wow, there's so little actual baseball in this movie.
Right. And, you know, the faraway shots are of Babe Herman playing the Gehrig body double and someone who could swing the bat better than Cooper could. But, you know, considering that he was 40 years old and learning to play baseball for the first time, you look at what he did, it wasn't bad. It could have been a lot worse. It could have been William Bendix.
I was going to say, how would you rank Cooper's work versus William Bendix and Anthony Perkins in Fear Strikes Out?
I think Cooper was like Babe Ruth compared to those guys. Bendix, I just look at the Babe Ruth story and I find it to be one of the worst movies ever made. The director's son told me years ago that, you know, the studio rushed the film, they wanted it out in time for Babe Ruth to see it, and it probably caused him to die because he died shortly after that. The director, Roy Del Ruth, wanted the actor Paul Douglas, and the studio insisted on Bendix. Bendix was just horrible. And much as I love John Goodman, I love John's acting, but he wasn't right for the role of Babe Ruth either. In fact, Babe Ruth played Babe Ruth very well in Pride of the Yankees.
Yeah.
With Cooper's baseball skills, you rarely saw the ball connecting with the bat. And you'd hear the sound of the ball getting hit. But the one sequence that tells me he learned how to swing reasonably well was in the arcade scene where he's wearing a tuxedo, he's on his first date with Eleanor, and he's in a little cage that where a machine is pitching balls at him. And he hit it pretty well. It wasn't bad. Was it Gehrig-like? No. But it didn't matter. This was, you know, with a 10 to 12 minutes of baseball, and that meant an hour and 50 minutes of everything else. Goldwyn wanted a love story and the story of a courageous man facing death at the peak of his career. So this is what he got. This is what Goldwyn... The only thing Goldwyn would do was have a love story about a guy who happened to play baseball. He knew nothing about baseball. He came from Poland. He didn't use sports as a way to assimilate into American culture. So this was what he was going to do. He was very clear. He spoke a lot about it before the making of the film and after it was out. That, you know, you want baseball, go to a ballpark. And the origin, probably the most important person behind the making of the film, is Niven Bush. Bush, who first met Gehrig in 1929, he did a profile of him for The New Yorker. He was so unimpressed with him that he basically said, this guy is so dull, he doesn't deserve a public, he doesn't deserve fans. 12 years later, he's a screenwriter and a story editor for Goldwyn, and he says to Goldwyn, we should make a movie about Gehrig. He had just died. And Goldwyn said no. And then he got the newsreels, then intact. And he shows them to Goldwyn in his screening room, and Goldwyn is crying after the first showing. And he says, show it again. Shows it again. And the lights go up, and he says, go contact Jim Mulvey. Mulvey was his number two guy in New York. Get in contact with Eleanor Gehrig. Without that kind of cajoling from Niven Bush, it wouldn't have happened. And Niven Bush went on to marry Teresa Wright late in the filming of the movie. And, Goldwyn's probably saw as he watched those newsreels everything that he needed to know. A guy is standing there, and I'm sure he was briefed on what happened to Gehrig, standing there saying he's the luckiest man on the face of the earth. And he's dying. And he's thanking everybody, and there's nothing maudlin about it, and he cries. And this is perfect for a guy who loved romantic movies, loved to make weepers. So this was, I'm sure he saw it very, very quickly, and then he saw the love story once he got to know Eleanor. So I think he was inadvertently brilliant, because if he'd made a baseball movie with a lot of baseball action with Gary Cooper in it, no one would remember the movie.
Now, of course, Yankee fans and baseball fans know about Gehrig's tragic situation, but what about the rest of the country when they saw the movie? As you say, it wasn't a baseball movie. It was a movie that had baseball in it. So how did that this help perpetuate the legend of Gehrig?
Oh, yeah, I think it is crucial to the legend of Gehrig. I mean, in the immediate aftermath, it was the highest grossing film Goldwyn had made to that point. By 1943, Cooper was touring the South Pacific with a USO troop, and sometime early in the tour, one of these soldiers yells out, "Hey, Coop, can you do the Gehrig speech?" And he says, "Well, let me sit down and write it down, because I didn't memorize it." And at every stop he made throughout November and December 43, he delivered the speech, the last one being in Sydney, Australia. And then since then, you know, you'd think a movie would fade away. It's never faded away. And the speech that Cooper delivers is the only intact version of the speech. So the speech that we remember that Gary giving is really the one that Cooper gave. It's a little bit different. It's a little bit shorter. The luckiest man line, as far as we know, was the second line in Gary's delivery, was moved for dramatic emphasis to the end of Cooper's. And I think when people think about it, it is, I'd say, 95% going to be the one that Cooper delivered. The real aficionados know whatever is there to know of what's left of the Gehrig version. But it's my belief that that Gehrig is remembered more because he's the association with the pride of the Yankees. That title which Goldwyn said came from the secretary, was inadvertently perfect. He is the pride of the Yankees, and he was then, he still is. So I think probably more than any portrayal of a famous figure, this has got to be in the top three of successfully perpetuating the image and the life of the character, even if some of the stuff in the movie is not true.
You mentioned that Ruth did a great job of portraying himself in the movie. Given the legendary animosity between Ruth and Gehrig, what did Eleanor feel about his inclusion in the film?
Well, Eleanor did not want him in the film. She felt that he would steal scenes from Cooper, who now, basically, he was Gehrig, and she didn't want that. Ruth, she felt, was, you know, kind of uncontrollable. But what she probably realized as well is that this movie was not going to be a pure baseball movie, you probably had to attract baseball fans with some verisimilitude, and that is centered almost entirely on Ruth. Ruth does some silent movies, and I looked at, you know, the one scene that I'm very fond of is in the Harold Lloyd comedy Speedy. There's a 5-minute scene with Ruth as a passenger in Harold Lloyd's cab, and Harold Lloyd is driving like a lunatic, and Ruth is really conveying his fear and his anxiety, and it's just 5 minutes, and he played himself very well. Another movie, another short there, where he's the manager of an all-girls team, and at one point he dresses up in drag. It's hysterical. He was a big goofball. He was a natural. He was his own best character. So there was no way that Goldwyn was not going to use Ruth. And even though Ruth couldn't play like Ruth anymore, he could still swing like Ruth. So when you see scenes far away and close up of Gehrig swinging, you didn't need a body double for him. He lost 48 pounds or so to play himself because he'd gotten well fat in retirement. It was in 1935 was his last year, so it was 7 years since he had played. Just eating, drinking, and playing a lot of golf is, and, you know, that was his profession. And he really wanted to be in it because he'd been somewhat forgotten. Nobody wanted to manage a team. And he was happy to be with his old teammates. So Eleanor, you know, she basically had to tolerate the fact that he had to be there. She specifically said she didn't want him to be in any scenes alone. And I don't think he was, and that might not have been anything from her input. It just could have been, well, he had to be in a scene with somebody. She was kind of derisive of Ruth in a letter she sent to Christy Walsh when Ruth was in the hospital for 2 weeks with pneumonia. And she basically said, well, he's not going to get the same amount of attention for this as he got from the bellyache heard around the world in 1925. Where he was really seriously ill, but his pneumonia was pretty serious as well. He was placed in what was called a pneumonia jacket. I don't know what that does, but once he started feeling better, he started receiving, you know, reporters and photographers in his hospital room, and he was living it up in the hospital room. So, you know, there was certainly animosity. I don't think Ruth felt much animosity towards Gehrig. I think it was Eleanor's animosity towards Ruth that sort of filtered over to Lou. Lou was not an angry guy. Eleanor could be an aggressive, tough broad in the best sense of the word. She was very protective of him. She was more sophisticated. She introduced him to a wider world of opera and books, and she was a genuine baseball fan, and he made her more of a fan. You could see his influence on her in the letters she made criticizing some of the some parts of the script. She understood baseball. So when you see her in the Teresa Wright in the movie at a White Sox game, That was one of the things that Paul Gallico got right. She was a White Sox fan, and she would go, and she probably saw the Yankees many times over the years. So she getting back to your question, she didn't want Ruth in there, and you know Ruth had to be there because you had to draw baseball fans in, and it probably was a winning formula.
Now, he wasn't the only Yankee who was in the film. Bill Dickey had a relatively large role compared to some of the other Yankees in it. Now, he was a good friend to Gehrig.
Probably his closest friend and his roommate.
So do you have a sense of what that was like for him to be doing this?
Well, he resisted the requests to be in the movie for a while. He told Eleanor that he just can't look at somebody else and call him Lou Gehrig. So it was... I think it was tough for him, but I think he overcame that because he was pretty good in his role. He also got a role for his wife in there when she comes over to him to speak training and says, "What's wrong with Lou?" That's, you know, she, Viola Dickey, was a showgirl, so she was kind of natural on screen also. You know, and Dickey plays, you know, Dickey famously, you know, punches out one of the players who gets, you know, is fed up with Lou being no longer being a good ball player. The Dickey role, not played by Dickey, is even more prominent in the very, very awful Lou Gehrig movie played, the Lou Gehrig segment of an anthology series in the 50s on CBS. But it's a dreadful movie. But she, in that movie, Eleanor basically uses Dickey to try to get Lou to go to a hospital. Or go to a doctor and check out why he's falling down. You know, in part of the Yankees, you saw very little of the impact of the ALS in this movie on CBS. He just kept falling on his face. It was kind of embarrassing. And in the movie in the 70s, they showed Edward Herman as Gehrig dying, but you didn't see a lot of the infirmity. You didn't see him some kind of walking uncertainly, but in the end, you saw the death scene.
I can't imagine. I know I've seen that movie a long time ago, but I can't picture Ed Herman in my mind being an athlete.
No, and there was even less baseball action in there than there was in part of the Yankees. But the Wendell Corey version in the 60s and the 50s was absolutely dreadful. I mean, you know, when I was searching fruitlessly to find more of the newsreel footage, I came upon a link to this movie, and so I thought, oh, great. So I fast-forwarded it, and it's the same footage that we've seen with Wendell Corey's voiceover you know, substituting for Gehrig's voice. It was just, you know, all kinds of awful. It was a pretty bad one. Fortunately, you know, if there have been three movies made about Gehrig, one was great, one was pretty good, one was dreadful. All three Babe Ruth movies have been awful, which is hard to believe since, you know, he was such a great character. How can you mess that up?
Yeah, well, it's an awful burden to bear to have to live up to.
I guess, but, you know, you don't have to make things up. The thing I always point to in the Babe Ruth story as just the height of stupidity was the same doctor who treated the dog that Bendix injured with a sharp grounder into foul territory, treated Babe at the end for cancer. So, you know, you just can't do that.
How many times do you figure you watch Pride of the Yankees just in researching this book?
Not many times straight through, probably 15 times straight through, but, you know, I had it on I had it online. I bought it from iTunes or wherever, and I would go to certain scenes, you know, repeatedly, just to make sure I quoted it right or I had the correct sequencing. Because what I wanted to do in a couple of chapters was to tell the story of the movie, because there might be people who read the book who haven't seen the movie, and just tell the parallel story of how certain things evolved. So I had to have a proper sequence. I had to just understand things. I had to know if I was telling the story of how, you know, there was a scene early on that was cut out where the young Lou was playing baseball in the sandlot with his friends. He's 12 years old or so. And before we see his long hit crash into the merchant's window and breaking it, there is a scene that was written in the final, in what was marked as the final script, where he's looking at, where young Lou is looking at the pitcher, and all of a sudden the pitcher turns into Christy Mathewson, and the sandlot becomes the Polo Grounds, and Lou's home run is a World Series winning home run. You just had to find exactly where that would have been if they had filmed it. And, you know, I think that might have been an interesting sequence, but it might have, you know, it might not have worked. Maybe that's why the director didn't shoot it. It probably retained its innocence by not having it in there. But it seemed to be cut out at the very last minute.
In doing the research of this book, what surprised you the most?
I really do think it was Eleanor's animosity towards Ruth. You see it in her book, but you see it even more in the materials, how much she disliked her mother-in-law. And that influence, Paul Gallico, in writing the first script with a partner, really absorbed that, and the early scripts really retain much more animosity than we've seen in the final cut. There was just hatred there. The early versions had her had Mom Gehrig's dialogue written in phonetic English, however you want to term that, and it was sort of like cartoon nasty German immigrant. It was just awful to read. But I think when you see the final version, you see the only way that it could have worked, because you couldn't maintain that animosity through more than half the film, because about halfway through, after the whole shopping incident, and Lou steps in and says, you know, send the Schifferow home and all that stuff, and that's when Eleanor really realizes that he's putting his mother in her place. Then Elsa Jansson's demeanor changes. Elsa Jansson played Mother Gehrig, so she starts becoming interested in baseball. She starts deferring to Eleanor. She starts actually smiling, and you see her and Pop Gehrig at the ballpark, and, you know, she's talking about why this, you know, manager didn't do this or that. So she's been transformed, but if that anger had maintained itself, if we had seen in the movie a scene where, Lou is dying, and Eleanor and Mom Gehrig are arguing over whose cooking, you know, might have caused Lou's illness, which is revealed in the letters that I found, you wouldn't have had the Pride of the Yankees. it would have been, I don't know, better, you know, I can't find a better term than a catfight. And it was really, really vicious. Now, of course, we only have Eleanor's version of this. We don't have anything from Mom Gehrig. We don't have anything independently from Lou. But one of my colleagues here at the paper, David Waldstein, did a story a few months ago about the still pending the pending sale of Gehrig's home in New Rochelle that he bought for his parents, and he lived there until he got married. And it was foreclosed on, and it was in his parents' name, I believe. And he didn't step forward to save it from foreclosure, which is a little unusual. But David speculates, or somebody else speculated, that it's possible that Eleanor told Lou, don't pay it. So they had to leave the house. So there was a lot of bad blood in there. And one of the great moments that showcases this is a scene without any words. It's when Cooper brings Teresa Wright home, and there's a big crowd in the mom and pop Garrick's house, and Elsa Danson gets a look at Eleanor's Teresa Wright's hand with a glittering diamond ring there, and there is this look of utter fear and mixed with complete anger. It's sort of like I'm losing my son, you know, and who is this young woman taking my son away from me? And that's about as nasty as it can get without any words. And but again, the final version softened Mother Gehrig almost into a comic character. I mean, she goes from being the put upon, hardworking, stern, you're going to be an engineer mother, and she goes on to become kind of a comic figure who loves baseball and wouldn't hear her son not playing in his 2000th consecutive game, where he jokes that he's not going to go there. In fact, Mom and Pop Gehrig really are the comic relief of the film.
And I'm going to get you out of here on this.
Okay.
Why does baseball make for such great reading, but such terrible movies?
Well,
or you don't disagree with that.
Well, I do disagree with that. Sports as a whole are not easy to put on film, because if you have too much sports action, then what's the story? Then the story has to be a climactic, ninth inning grand slam. You look at the 1980s bunch of movies: Field of Dreams, Bull Durham, 8 Men Out, The Natural. Those are all pretty damn good movies. And that may have been the peak of baseball.
The age of baseball movies.
It could have been. Mm-hmm. It could have been. They all covered different kind of ground. In fact, when I spoke to Ron Shelton about the book, he didn't make the final cut. But he said that he absolutely detested Pride of the Yankees, and mainly for its lack of good baseball action. And he said one of the motivating forces for making Pride of the Yankees was how much he hated, for making Bull Durham was how much he hated Pride of the Yankees. He said his mother loved Pride of the Yankees for the love story. And in fact, Ben Mankiewicz, whose great uncle Herman co-wrote the final script, Ben said to me, it took him a long time to come around to understanding that it wasn't a baseball movie, that it was a love story. And on that level, it works extremely well. And I think that plus the speech are why it works. I'll throw in 42 as a very good baseball movie too. Even though, like most baseball movies and sports movies, it has a lot wrong. There was a scathing article about the mistakes in 42, that including the Pittsburgh pitcher who went headhunting against Jackie Robinson when it wasn't true. But I go back to a story I heard from a producer of a Showtime movie about Rocky Marciano. It was a mediocre movie, And one thing that caught my eye was a scene, a very emotional scene, where Marciano goes to Denver to visit Joe Louis. Now, he'd beaten Joe Louis to a pulp, but he loved Joe Louis. And Joe is in, I think, a mental institution, and he goes there and gives him a bag of cash. Marciano was notoriously parsimonious, and he would look in legendary looking seat covers and, you know, pull-up seat covers or cushions in the couch and look for coins. And this scene was set to take place in 1970. Well, by then, Marciano had died in a plane crash. So I talked to the producer, and I said to him, "Wait, you really can't do that." He said, "Well, it could have happened." You know, he would have done that.
Uh-huh.
I said, "Yes, if he hadn't died in a plane crash." So, you know, the as told to the based on a true story genre is always fraught with this stuff. In fact, part of Gallico's contract was to detail which scenes were absolutely truthful, which scenes were based on something Eleanor told him, and which scenes were fictional. 2/3 fell into the fictional and stuff Eleanor told me, and 1/3 was factual. You know, that's what happens. It was a very early As Told To movie. And, you know, there's one very elaborate scene that I believe came out of something Eleanor told him that got cut out, that I write about in the book, that, as everybody knows, Lou, after he had to retire, traveled with the team for a while and then didn't get a job with the Yankees and became a New York City parole commissioner. And he kept doing it until he could barely move. So there's a scene in the script where Lou meets with a teenage dope fiend and thief, a young woman named Mary, and she comes in all angry and, you know, nasty, and if it were a more modern day script, she would have been, you know, cursing at Garrick. And I believe this might be based on a real life encounter between Lou and Rocky Graziano, the born Rocky Barbato. And as they're talking to each other, she sees that the ashes are falling off of Garrick's cigarette, and he's not doing anything about it, mainly because he can barely move. And it turns out that Mary says to him that she has cancer, she's going to die soon. He said, "Well, I'm going to die soon too." And it's a very, very maudlin scene. And but I, you know, I think about it, and I think, okay, maybe the screenwriters thought that this was dealing with a young woman was maybe more dramatic than dealing with a young boxer. So, you know, this is the kind of stuff that Gallico and the other writers were trying out. They were, you know, ultimately, if anybody seriously considered that parole commissioner scene, it would have been ridiculous because Gallico placed it right before the Luckiest Man scene. So here he is in his office, barely able to move, and the next scene he's walking into the stadium delivering a speech. So, and you couldn't put it after the speech because the speech is, and his walk-off afterwards is a perfect ending. So they were trying. I do think Gallico was looking for some way to throw in, you know, the parole job and so on. But the parole job, you know, he had to be driven to and from by either Eleanor or maybe a friend or a driver. And he was there until he couldn't do anything for himself.
All this makes for a wonderful story in the Pride of the Yankees, Lou Gehrig, Gary Cooper, and the making of a classic. We've been talking with the author, Richard Sandomir. Richard, thank you so much for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
Visit Ron Kaplan's BaseballBookshelf.com for the latest news and reviews and interviews with my favorite people in the baseball pop culture world. In the meantime, if you have a question, drop me a line at RonKaplan'sBaseballBookshelf.com. Sorry, that's Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf @gmail.com, and visit me on Twitter @RonKaplanNJ. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you next time.